You're listening to Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow. And for the rest of the hour, we're going to talk about more parallels between humans and marine mammals. And we're going to focus on a marine mammal that, it turns out, has quite a bit in common with us. And those are those lovable dolphins. Think about it. They have very big brains like humans. They suffer, believe it or not, some very similar viral infections. They get common colds like we do. And the papillomavirus. I bet a lot of people didn't know that, these kinds of things that the dolphins are suffering from. And they even have a condition. This is really surprising. They have a condition that resembles diabetes, and they're not drinking all those milkshakes, eating the chips and the soda and the other junk food that's in our modern human diet, which makes you wonder, why would dolphins even have this sort of diabetes if they're not eating that kind of stuff? Is there something beneficial that they would have diabetes? And does it tell us something about our own human diabetes and maybe a way to treat it or cure it if these dolphins can sort of turn it on and off as they can, which we'll learn. Let me introduce my guest. Dr. Stephanie Van Watson is a veterinary epidemiologist. She's also director of clinical research at the National Marine Mammal Foundation here in San Diego. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hey, great to be here, Ira.
Nice to have you. Dr. Hendrik Nolens is a clinical assistant professor of zoological medicine at the University of Florida, and he's also based here in San Diego. Welcome to Science Friday.
Pleasure to be here.
Let's talk, Dr. Van Watson, first of all, about the dolphins you study. Where do they live? How do they get there? Where do you study them?
Sure. Well, I get to brag about amazing population of dolphins with which we work. These are the marine mammals that work with the Navy Marine Mammal Program, and it's a population of about 60 to 70 dolphins, and their main job for the Navy is to find and detect underwater objects, whether it's objects lost at sea or mines or underwater swimmers, and even recently some humanitarian demining efforts looking for getting some of those World War II mines that are lost there in the ocean.
So they let you come in, and where they're housed here in San Diego? Or
they are. They live
and
in
they let you come in and study them.
They live in San Diego Bay. Well, there's an exchange for that. My job as a veterinary epidemiologist is really to take care of that population of dolphins. What we're going to talk about with the diabetes, we'll get into an accidental mistake that's leading to an exciting new direction.
Tell us about it right now.
Okay. I couldn't wait.
Yeah, I know. I find it very surprising. I love when these serendipitous things happen, right?
Yeah.
How did you discover about the diabetes in the dolphins?
Sure. Well, we started with a study that we thought was going to be quite boring. We're going to compare CBC and chemistry. So basically, when you and I go to the doctor and we get that series of 30 blood tests run, we do the same things to look at the health of the dolphins. And so we just wanted to determine some normal reference ranges, comparing the dolphins that had fasted overnight to those that had been recently fed. And when we got the results, we were very surprised to find that the changes during the animals that had fasted, they didn't match other animals' fasting states. They matched results from studies looking at people with diabetes versus those without diabetes. And these are big studies comparing huge populations of people. And we're seeing these changes in the same population of dolphins, the same animals, where when they have fast in the morning, they are diabetic-like, and when they eat, they all of a sudden aren't diabetic.
Is that how humans are in the same way?
That is not how humans are.
No, I just think it's just the opposite, isn't it?
It's very interesting.
Yeah.
It's usually comparing different groups of people with disease or without disease for these animals to be able to switch something
they
on
can
and
switch
off.
It on and off at will.
We think are driven by something, whether it's
yeah.
food or diurnal rhythms, but it's quite amazing, and there appears to be a reason for that.
If you feed them junk food, do they go into the diabetes like type 2 that we have in humans?
Very interesting question. If actually 40 years ago, the father of marine mammal medicine, Sam Ridgway, did this work where we dug through the Navy archives and pulled out thousands of handwritten data points, turned them into an electronic database, and found that when dolphins are fed sugar, their blood glucose goes up and goes way up and stays up for like 10 hours, and that's very similar is a hallmark of diabetes in people.
1-800-989-8255 is our number, talking about dolphins and the similarities they have to people. Also here in San Diego, if you want to step up to the microphone, always had a question about Flipper? No. Or something like your dolphins are not named Flipper, are they?
No, we have no Flippers.
No Flippers. That's good. We had enough of one dolphin named Flipper, I think. 1-800-989-8255. So what can you learn about by studying the diabetes in the dolphins about how that might work with people.
Sure. So what does this all mean to us?
You asked a good question.
Well, first of all, this genetic fasting switch, this potential for a dolphin to have a genetic fasting switch that can turn diabetes on and off is exciting.
Yeah.
So if we could find that switch and control it in humans, it could potentially control the precursor for type 2 diabetes, which is insulin resistance, and could lead to the cure for diabetes. And we're a long ways away from that, but the dolphin genome has been mapped, and obviously the human genome has been mapped, and we can start looking for those fasting genes and whether when they switch on and off and potentially controlling them.
Do we know how they're able to... Are they cues, obviously, from the food, or is there other cues? Are they mental cues that might be happening?
It's potential. We don't know the answer yet, but the potential is, or the most likely answer is when they eat and when they don't eat. So when they fast, basically they eat fish, which have very little sugar in it, and we know that their big brains need lots of sugar. So how do they keep that sugar going in their blood when they're fasting? And so the argument is that with type 2 diabetes, helps the liver create sugar and feeds that brain during a fasting state. So it may be the fasting.
Yeah, interesting. Hendrik Nolan's I didn't know a dolphin. I guess I should have thought that a dolphin can catch a cold, right?
They sure can.
Yeah, we catch cold viruses. Are there viruses in the water that they swim around in?
Let's backtrack a little bit. A few years ago, we didn't know anything or much of about viral diseases in any marine mammals, including dolphins. And over the last few years, we have learned a lot really quick. And one of the viruses that we did detect and did work up was, it's called a parainfluenza virus, which is a virus that is associated with common cold in humans, among other species. And actually, when we worked it up, it turned out that the virus causes an exact, a very similar disease syndrome. Some animals do not show any clinical signs. They're fine. They just, fend it off. Other ones are just more vague. They don't feel well, and they want to stay in bed all day, and they don't feel like eating. And other ones do develop more obvious respiratory signs. So, yeah, they do get a common cold.
Could they be sharing that with us? Can they pass it? I'm thinking of the avian flu, the swine flu. Could there be flus out there or viruses out there that have a mixture of all those different genetic components, and maybe there's a bit of a dolphin in one of those that we catch?
Well, probably not so much this cold virus, but there are viruses. One thing we have learned is that there are viruses in the marine environment, in the ocean, that do meet, that have all the same characteristics of the recent big emerging diseases, the recent big emerging disease viruses. So if we think of HIV and SARS, West Nile virus, these were all RNA viruses that came from wildlife and that had the potential to jump hosts. And one of the things that we have learned is, again, not this cold virus, but that some of these other viruses do have some means of interaction with human viruses and even recombine and swap pieces of genetic information. So it's not impossible.
But no one has been able to show it yet.
Well, there is a virus group actually from California sea lions. It's a Khaleesi virus. It's called San Miguel sea lion virus that historically has made its way onto land in the U.S. and actually set up shop and caused disease in domestic pigs. And this virus has been found since in fish and amphibians, and even in humans it's associated. Exposure to this virus is associated with chronic active hepatitis. Mm-hmm. So there are precedents.
Mm-hmm. You both work with dolphins. How do you tell when a dolphin is sick? I mean, it doesn't come up and...
Sure, there.
It's a little Blue Cross card and say.
They're amazingly good at masking disease, and that would
work. They mask the disease.
They are very good at it. It would work to their advantage out in the wild. You don't want to show a weakness out there. So a lot of times what's good about things like the Navy Marine Mammal Program is that they're able to watch. The trainers know their animals really well. And so when a dolphin is sick, usually the first sign is just they appetite is decreased.
Mm.
So even
stop
if,
eating.
Yeah, they stop eating, and they just may seem a little tired.
Do they cough or sneeze?
They can cough.
Yeah, sometimes they do. The most sensitive marker for telling if an animal is sick or not are the trainers. So the trainers do work with these animals, and they know them every day, and they will even pick up on subtle things like saying, this animal is slow. Usually he swims in front of me. Now he's behind me, these sort of things. So they are key in picking up early disease in these animals because exactly they've been selected to hide their weaknesses. In the wild, you can't tell at all. You can't tell until they are on the beach dead or dying, really.
So they're not getting a runny nose in the eyes and things like that. Could you tell that was happening?
Usually infections are picked up. After seeing a dolphin doesn't have a very good appetite would be taking a blood sample. And the veterinarian can go and look to see if there are changes that are very similar to that we would see in people.
So you do take blood samples of them?
We do. And I love to brag about that as well. But
are they good patients?
They are excellent patients.
Do they have a choice?
Actually, what's amazing is the dolphins in this population give voluntary blood samples.
Is that like volunteering in the military? I need a volunteer for a blood sample.
We get cookies and orange juice in exchange, and they do it with nothing else in exchange. So there's got to be something good going on there. But if a blood sample is needed, even a urine sample, the trainers, the veterinary technicians can go down to these dolphins and they stick their tail out of the air and they give their samples. It's quite amazing. They live in the open bay and they stick with us. It's a great partnership.
Would they get a lollipop when they're...
Well, then they might have high blood sugar levels.
But they get rewarded with their fish. You know, you see trainers giving.
Maybe, oh, sure.
Yeah.
Maybe a big herring or a
salmon. Big herring. A little sushi for doing this. Is there a season? Now, we have cold and flu season, but are there seasons for dolphins getting sick in the water?
There are, and it varies by disease. There's certain diseases that we see in the wild animals up and down the coast in spring, such as the same Khaleesi virus. Again, with this flu virus, we actually saw the peak of this virus around calving season, and again with astroviruses, which is a virus that causes diarrhea in most other species, we again see the exposure peak in spring season, which is usually around calving, which makes sense because you have all these immunologically naive animals who come into the population who are susceptible to any of the pathogens or the viruses, bacteria that may be circulating.
Mm-hmm. So. Is the water that we think is, you know, is clean and beautiful and clear, is it swimming with viruses, like the air, if we could see the viruses here?
It actually is. 20, 30 years ago, we thought oceans were completely sterile, that they were dead zones. And we've known for quite a few years now that that's not true, that the ocean is actually packed with bacteria. But even in more recent years, we've now learned that the seawater contains tons of viruses. 1 microliter of seawater can contain several million virus particles. Now, most of those viruses are only able to infect the bacteria that also float in the seawater, but some of them may very well have human or animal disease potential, too.
1-800-989-8255. Yes, sir.
Yeah, hi, Craig Stevens from OSU Tulsa. Well, as far as you can get from marine mammal in these states, I had a question for Dr. Van Watson. Do you think your findings would apply to wild animals as well, or is it a result of the Navy diet or captivity?
It's a good question. We are afforded an amazing opportunity to track these animals very closely, and we're looking at very subtle, elegant trends that you pick up over tracking these animals for 10, 20, 30 years. But it is a question that we have, and we are looking at wild populations. The problem is even when we get urine and blood samples, we don't know the health history of the animal. When did that animal last eat? So we're out there trying to answer the question, but we're also looking at dietary differences that may be between wild dolphins and dolphins at the Navy. Like, do wild dolphins fast overnight? And if they don't, then are there things that we could change that could potentially decrease any negative side of diabetes? But the exciting part of this research is that it seems diabetes seems to be a natural, healthy state for these animals. Mm-hmm.
We're talking about dolphins this hour in Science Friday from NPR here in San Diego, where they have lots of dolphins and many places to see them. Talking with us, Dr. Stephanie Van Watson and Dr. Hendrik Nolens. Did you ever find that there might be an ideal diet to feed dolphins in captivity? Can you know... They're here. They're not out to free. You know, we know wild animals are usually healthier and left in the wild.
We're looking at the diet in animals, and actually, we're real excited about the fact that when you're looking at health indicators of populations, and when we look at, there are many different ways that you can look at the health of a population, annual survival rates of animals and whatnot. And dolphins at the Navy, as well as other of the big institutions, are actually starting to show that survival rates of these dolphins are actually equal to, or not higher than, those in the wild. But we are looking at, is there potential that our quality of our diet is actually too good for these animals? We're giving them very high protein fish, and maybe we need to make it a little simpler for them sometimes.
Let me see if we get a quick call before the break here. Let's go to Diane in Brooklyn, New York. Hi, Diane.
Hi, how are you?
Hi there.
I was wondering, I had heard that dolphins are the only animal or mammal that consciously commits suicide. Is that true?
Henrik?
I'll try to answer that one. To the best of my knowledge, no. The only scenario that would come even remotely to this, I would say, is actually the a stranding event. So marine mammals, seals and sea lions are able to move around on land and freely. So for those animals to come on land is not a problem, is not uncommon. Now, what we do find is that animals, dolphins or whales that are sick or out of place or whichever reason, they do sometimes beach themselves on land. And actually, that reflex is almost the opposite of a suicide, because what we don't know, probably 99% of stranded animals, we actually never know what caused them to strand. But one of the thinking is, and it seems a very logical one, is that these animals are actually feeling weak. They feel they're dying, and so they're trying to prevent drowning.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I was learning from research is that just on the other side, the flip side, is that dolphins are one among the few animals we know that have sex for fun, right?
They
not
do.
Just
that's
to correct. Procreate.
They do.
That's why Flipper was dancing on the water all the time.
They do. There are some interesting YouTube videos out there.
and they mate face to face, right? Like people.
They do. Yeah. Usually the female will swim on the surface and the male will come up underneath and roll over. And so yeah, it's.
So that's the good side of the studying
exactly.
Dolphins. And there are a lot of other things that dolphins do that are similar to people. But one of the most thing that we think about all the time is the size of their brain. We have to take a break, but when we come back, I want to talk about how that affects the research that you do. You know, we think that these are very intelligent creatures. You know, we look at that from their brain size. Does that affect what kinds of research, thinking that they're intelligent and maybe they have different, you know, different consciousness that we would think than other animals have, does that affect the kinds of research that you might want to think about doing on them, because you don't want to hurt them, their feelings, or things like that? So we're going to take a quick break and come back and talk lots more with Dr. Stephanie Van Watson, who's a veterinary epidemiologist, and Dr. Henrik Nolens, a clinical assistant professor of zoological medicine. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Stay with us. Please come up here in the audience if you'd like to ask a question. We'll be right back after this short break. I'm Ira Flatow. You're listening to Science Friday from NPR. We're here in San Diego talking about dolphins with Dr. Stephanie Van Watson. She is a veterinary epidemiologist and she's also director of clinical research at the National Marine Mammal Foundation here in San Diego. Dr. Henrik Nolens is a clinical assistant professor of zoological medicine at the University of Florida and based here in San Diego. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. And let me ask you, Dr. Van Watson, about this question I've always wondered about. If I live in the ocean all the time and I get a cut, it's going to be an open wound. You know, here I can put a Band-Aid on it, put some whatever, cut. How does a dolphin deal with getting injured like that? And they have real skin like we do because they're mammals, right?
They do. It's a great question that we're looking forward to answering even more. But what's observed out there, which is fascinating, is that dolphins in the wild, they've been well documented to sustain injuries, and sometimes it's from propeller wounds that run deep because of interactions with boats or whatnot. And some of these animals do get infections and they die. There are other animals that go on, they heal these wounds, and here they are sitting in the sea of bacteria and viruses that Henrik was talking about, and they not only heal these wounds, but they go on to reproduce, which is a sign of saying this is is kept as a productive member of society.
Yeah, do they have special healing powers that we don't have? Or does skin heal faster? Or?
It's believed that they're immune. They might have a really neat immune system that's specific to their skin. So we're even looking at things collaborating with outside researchers, looking at the potential for these regenerative cells, so these cells that can help them heal quickly, that's present in their adipose tissue, their fat. And humans and other animals also have these cells in their fat, but is there something special about the dolphin cells that that can teach us some neat things about healing ourselves?
So they heal quicker than we do?
We believe so. We believe that if we were in the same environment as them and sustaining the same wounds, we certainly would not heal the same way that those dolphins do.
Okay, let's go to the audience here. Yes, ma'am.
Madeline, and Dr. Vin Watson, you mentioned that you didn't have any dolphins named Flipper, but I was wondering if you do name your dolphins and how you feel about the phenomenon of naming research animals.
Sure. Well, the first is, yes, they have names, and we care for them tremendously. These are highly valued animals, both personally and for the mission that they do for the nation. Their job is not to be research animals. These animals are there to help do what they do. They find objects underwater, and they help the Navy and protect our nation. A nice side effect of having this population is that our job is to take really good care of these animals. And as part of taking good care of them is monitoring their health. What has happened is we have accidentally found these amazing simple discoveries just by monitoring health trends in animals and caring for them. So it goes much more into this one health approach where caring for one species, we can care for them all. Is the dolphin going to be a lab animal? No.
Why?
It's not.
Why?
I don't think it's going to happen. I think there is an affection that people have for marine mammals, including all of us here at the Foundation and the Navy. These are very special animals, but there's a lot we can learn from them by working with them.
Mm-hmm. Marine mammals are actually also one of the only animals that have a special protection act specifically dedicated to them. They're protected under the Marine Mammal Protection Act, so experimental research and so on is very limited. And they're even protected to the point where in the wild you're actually legally not allowed to approach a dolphin. They can approach you. They have permits, but you don't have permits to go up to them.
It's like penguins in Antarctica.
Yeah.
Do they have any other special privileges that, you know, just about besides not doing research on them? And I'm sure that comes because we think they're almost as intelligent as we are, right? Their brains are huge compared to their bodies.
They do. They have, if you look at something called a fancy word, encephalization quotient, or EQ, this is the measurement of their actual brain size compared to their expected brain size for their body size. And humans are the biggest. We get that bragging right of 7.4. Dolphins come next down on the line at 5.3, and it's amazing when you look at something like a rhesus monkey, which we typically say is close to a human, is down at 2.4. So dolphins and humans do have these very similar large brains, which, getting back to the diabetes picture, these large brains need lots of sugar, available sugar, to feed them. And so we think that's why dolphins and humans, with something as obscure as a disease like diabetes, that might be why they have something in common.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the audience here. Yes.
Hi, my name's Laura, and I'm a AAAS policy fellow in the NOAA Climate Program Office. I have a general question. So there are so many challenges associated with studying marine diseases. For example, trying to isolate pathogens out of the water column or understanding transmission rates when you have such an open system. What are some of the emerging areas of technology or maybe new collaborations that are being formed to get a more comprehensive understanding of diseases in the oceans?
I think this is probably a question for me. I'd say there are a few things. First, you need to get the right people to come together. Learning diseases from wild animals is really hard because usually you can only get to dead stranded animals on the beach, which majority of the time are too decomposed to even get cause a death on these animals. In our case, we actually for our program our lab is a product of a collaboration between the U.S. Navy Marine Mammal Program, the SeaWorld Parks, Hub SeaWorld Institute here in San Diego, and then the University of Florida. And so combined, there are a lot of this is a big group of animals who are under human care and who have medical records that go back decades and so on. So this is an incredible resource for learning about which pathogens these animals are exposed to and then what it actually does to these animals. So that's probably key. Then the second part of what we do is once we have an agent characterized, whether this is a virus, in our case it's a virus, but other people work on bacteria or parasite or fungi, we go out and go and survey some of these wild populations or other collections to get an idea for how well how these agents behave in the wild versus, you know, under animals that are under human care and receive medical care.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Let's go to the phone to Tanya in Anchorage. Hi, Tanya.
Hi.
Hi there. Go ahead.
I was wondering about picking up tuberculosis from a dolphin. And the reason for my question, just as a quick background, is I went to college in Texas and worked for the Marine Mammal Stranding Network. Before I went, I took a TB time test, and the time test showed that I didn't, I mean, was negative. I didn't have any TB exposure. After I was done working with the dolphins, I ended up getting sick after working with the dolphin, got the pneumonia, took a TB time test, and they diagnosed me with TB. And they suggested, but they weren't sure, that I could have picked from a dolphin. I was wondering if there's any merit to that.
Andrew?
Well, tuberculosis in humans is caused by a bacteria called Mycobacterium tuberculosis. And various marine animals, both sea lions in New Zealand and cetaceans, so dolphins, sea turtles, get Mycobacterium infections. So bacteria that belong to that same group of Mycobacteria. Now, of all the reports of Mycobacteria infections in dolphins, none of them are actually with M. tuberculosis. None of them are the group of bacteria that causes these lung abscesses, such as M. tuberculosis or M. avium would do. So if you were to, on a serologic test, were to cross-react with a Mycobacterium from a dolphin, like M. abscessus or Marinum, I would not be surprised at that, but I would be very surprised if the M. tuberculosis came from a dolphin. I would think that's just I would expect that to be just a coincidence of timing.
Okay, Tanya.
Thank you.
Thanks for an interesting call, but they're close enough. You're saying that the different bacteria that
they do belong to the same bacterial family, but the bacteria themselves are very different.
Yeah. Okay, sir, right here.
Hello, I'm Brian Mosley from the Kansas City Zoo. And my question was, do you ever find, like, isolated populations of marine mammals that are susceptible to these diseases, or is the water all mixed together, or do they have, like, surfaces that they contact or something like that?
Wow, that's a long and a complicated answer. We do find first of all, I should say we know very little about the dynamics of disease in wild populations, in part because because we don't get access to these animals, and also for a long time the assays didn't exist to study them. What we do know is that some things, for example, a bacterial kidney infection in sea lions called leptospirosis is very, very common in sea lions in Northern California. Down here in Southern California, it's very rarely seen. So there are differences. Now, what these differences, you know, what is the reason for these differences, geographical differences, we don't know, because there's a pretty good water exchange between Northern California and Southern California. Animals migrate up and down the coast. I wouldn't be surprised to see differences between the Atlantic and the Pacific, because, you know, you're geographically isolated. But there are smaller scale geographical trends, too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Another question about you were intriguing me by talking about the sea of viruses that they're swimming in the oceans. And one of those that I was thinking about and I've heard about is the genital papillomavirus. You know, there's a human papillomavirus that might lead to cancer. Is there something similar in that sea of viruses that might be affecting the dolphins?
There is, and it probably doesn't come from the seawater. It may more be related to their sexual behavior, maybe, which is purely a hypothesis. But no, dolphins do get genital papillomavirus infections, and what is actually unique about them is that they are the only other species, other than humans, that we see multiple type infections at the same time. So where you can find if you take a cytobrush, like the equivalent of a pap smear, you can find up to 6, 7, 8, 9 papillomaviruses in there at the same time. And in the only other species that's been reported is in humans, and in humans there's actually the risk of malignant cervical neoplasia, so cancer, increases dramatically with the number of papillomaviruses present. And dolphins, there are no reported cases of
cervical cancer. So there are no cervical cancers?
No, there are cancers, but no cervical cancers.
Well, you'd want to know why, wouldn't you?
Exactly.
Would be great to know why they have the same thing, but they're not getting the cancers from.
Exactly, and maybe we could actually learn something from it to help prevent human disease.
Yeah. Let me ask you, Stephanie, if you fed humans eat a dolphin type of diet, like very high in protein, we've heard about people, would that hurt us? Like, if we feed dolphins junk food, they get something. If we ate a very high protein, would we get hurt? But our kidneys are sensitive to all this protein, right?
Yeah, it's a good question as far as what happens when a person with type 2 diabetes even potentially eats a high protein diet. There have been some short term studies, 3 to 5 week studies, in which people with type 2 diabetes were fed very high protein, very low sugar diets. And in those cases, these are people who are not on any other treatment. Blood sugar levels were under better control. It seemed that they were heading in the right direction. These were only 3 to 5 week studies. So the flip side is, as you had mentioned, Ira, that the high protein diets can have a very negative impact on kidney function. So there's a lot more that needs to be studied. An interesting subpopulation are the Eskimos. Alaskan Eskimos have, for a long time, eaten very high protein diets, much like those of dolphins. And those people, this population, has obviously sustained and thrived very well on this diet. Interestingly, now that they're starting to get more and more high carbohydrate type of diets shipped into them, the incidence of diabetes is starting to poke its head in those populations.
Wow, it's picking up. I want to thank both of you for taking time to be with us today. Dr. Stephanie Van Watson is veterinary epidemiologist and director of the clinical research at National Marine Mammal Foundation here in San Diego. Hendrik Nolens is a clinical assistant professor of zoological medicine at the University of Florida. Thank you. I'm going to have you sit by here because we're now bringing in Flora Lichtman, our video producer, on Science Friday from NPR.